Mr. Sachs, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to have 4 minutes for rebuttal.
4 minutes for rebuttal, okay.
That's acceptable to the court.
That's acceptable. You start whenever you like.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. It's nice to see you all again. A little bit out of breath already from the earlier one, but catching it as I speak. This is a matter, of course, on the merits. This is an appeal granted from this very circuit court, City of Norfolk, from a final order of September 22, 2015. The Honorable Michelle Atkins presiding, denying the appellant or defendant's motion for modification of the amended sentencing order of August 30, 2002. The procedural history of the case is important. August 30, 2002, then Judge Lydia Taylor of this court sentenced the defendant to one count of abduction, parental abduction, three counts of perjury, one count of conspiracy, and there were a number of conditions in the order upon which the suspended sentence was conditioned, including a no-contact provision with the defendant's then minor daughter. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Sachs, it seems that there was a bit of confusion as to what the trial judge was attempting to do, and obviously the trial judge was trying to correct the record to conform with the statutory requirements. And oftentimes when I look at a case, and you're an experienced counsel, and I'm sure you do this also, is I look at a case inside out. I say, okay, what if the situation was reversed? What if we had an order that said something that was advantageous to your client and a statement that was disadvantageous to your client? What would you do? You would say, okay, I want to rely on the order because it doesn't matter what the trial judge said. It matters what the trial judge wrote.
Well, I agree the order controls, Your Honor.
Okay.
But our position, it's an interesting procedural posture. We move to amend the order to take the no-contact provision out. Our sole assignment of error is an abuse of discretion in denying that motion. As I read the Commonwealth's brief, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure they'll correct me and be wrong with it, I didn't detect that they contested that. It was not an abuse of discretion. They have come in on a procedural issue, basically. Their position is that the court had no authority to amend the order because it was a condition of the suspended sentence, and only a condition of probation by statute can be amended after the 21 days. So they're taking the position that the 21-day bar barred the amendment or the modification that we requested.
Counsel, why are they wrong?
Because for a couple of reasons. First of all, that issue was never raised in the trial court by the Commonwealth in this case, so it wasn't preserved for appeal in this court. Now, I recognize that there is the rule right for the wrong reason, but I interpret that if the court had a merits reason that it cited, and that was the wrong merits reason, there's another merits reason why the issue would be correctly decided, then the court could still uphold. But
well, did the appellant note her objection to the court's ruling regarding the issue of no contact?
When the court, you mean at the very beginning?
Yes, sir.
Back in, I believe the record is silent on that, Your Honor. I think it's just simply silent.
It is.
But here's the interesting point. The Commonwealth, they have come forward with an affirmative defense, if you will, on procedural issue. So the record has to support what they say. Virginia Code Section 19.2-30, let's say they're right, and this is not modifiable after 21 days, just for the sake of argument. Virginia Code Section 19.2-303 states that if a defendant has not been delivered to a Department of Corrections unit, the order still remains under the control of the court. We even have cases, as you know, from the Supreme Court where somebody who's in federal custody hadn't been delivered to a State Department and their sentence could be modified. There is no evidence in this case as to when the defendant, if ever, there's no evidence in this record.
But whose burden is it on appeal to provide an adequate record for this court?
Well, although generally speaking, the appellant has the burden to make sure the record is full, but if the Commonwealth is bringing up something that is a bar, a default, or a procedural bar, I think they have to have, they didn't raise it in the lower court. If they raised it, we could have all addressed it. The court could have taken it under
advisement. They didn't raise it because it wasn't an issue.
What I'm talking about is in this case, in the motion to modify, not the original, excuse me, not the original order, the hearing on September 21, 2015, the Commonwealth's attorney or deputy Commonwealth's attorney's position was not that this is procedurally barred, but it is not in the interest of the court. It is, there's no good cause shown for modifying the order because the daughter has written the letter, even though she's 18, she doesn't want any contact, and therefore the court shouldn't do it. And that's what the judge rested her ruling on. That procedural question was never raised. No record. We had no opportunity to develop a record because they didn't raise it. The trial court had no opportunity to respond to it. And that, I think, is a classic situation. That's why the rules require it to be raised, so that we're not here and not right now trying to figure out and speculate. So, I'm
Mr.
sorry.
Sack,
yes,
if I may interrupt you.
Certainly.
In reference to the issue as far as talking about the rules.
Yes, ma'am.
We have a little problem potentially about Rule 5A20E in that in your argument you failed to cite any type of authority or any type of cases to support the position. I'm assuming given that you are clearly a very experienced attorney that clearly there just aren't any cases or there's not any real authority for
that. That was our opinion. We felt this was almost self-evident. The authority we cited was abuse of discretion for the standard, and it was really a fact-based determination. I can't put my fingers, I couldn't at the time, a case that controlled. It was more inherent in the fact. We cited the fact. I mean, the points of authority we cited are what's in the brief. I don't
but
know.
But you didn't cite any statute or anything.
No, we didn't cite a statute, but I don't think we had to. Because and the posture, the way, if you read the record below, none was cited below. It was really a fact-based, totally fact-based inquiry as to whether the court's discretion should be exercised. I don't think that rule is designed to bar a brief that is based on appropriate factual argument, cites the standard correctly, and argues the procedural history. I think it's where if somebody makes an argument that simply there's no support at all and just some bare bones contention and you don't support it with anything, then there might be an issue. But you
put us in a bad spot when you don't even cite a case to support the standard of review that you're asking us to apply.
Well, I think that is so obvious that that's what the standard is. I mean, I don't think we have, I think the rule says we have to cite, we have to address what the standard of review is, and I did that. I did address that. I don't think it has to be, there has to be a case. If it's so well established, and so we often cite a case to set it out, but we didn't in this instance because we didn't think it was necessary because the Commonwealth agrees that that's the standard. I don't think that's with all due respect to the court, a valid issue to cut off an otherwise meritorious appeal because there isn't a case cited specifically that supports it. That there doesn't have to be. If we're right, if we're correct, and if there isn't a case that falls in this domain, that would then mean that as long as you put some case in, even if it's not even remotely supported, you satisfy the rule. I think it's the spirit of the rule that it really, as opposed to sort of a black letter adherence to some sort of strict.
In other words, it's more about precision as opposed to perfection. You believe that you perfected the issue, but maybe you could have done it more precisely.
Well, I think that would be an accurate statement. I mean, I thought we had covered it. It wasn't a complicated matter. It seemed to be to us a question of discretion of the court. We had cited all the factual reasons. We supported it with evidence in the trial court as to why this condition no longer made sense and why it would be an abuse of discretion not to modify it. And the Commonwealth cited no authorities, simply put in the evidence from the child. And typically you don't cite authority when we have these orders entered at sentencing. It's usually not an authority-based decision either. So,
okay, counsel, I think I understand your argument regarding on that issue. But
yes, ma'am.
Back to the issue of
yes.
What you essentially are doing is collaterally attacking the first order. Is what you're doing through the second issue, which seems to be, and the Commonwealth did point out, I think part of the argument is the Rule 1-1, and you talked about that.
Yes.
Why you felt like it wasn't.
Yes.
But why, I mean, maybe I'm just a little bit slow on this. But,
no, you're not slow at all.
I
think I'm slow as me, but I'm trying to catch up.
Well, I, counsel, I don't adhere to the argument that we had a little while ago that judges never make mistakes. We do, and I certainly do. But I want to understand how you believe that you were able to collaterally attack an order that certainly has expired many, many years ago, and you're able to do that now with reviewing it in abuse of discretion. It seems like the place that your client should have preserved her position for appeal would have been in that first order. And I know you explained it, but maybe you can go through it again for me one more time.
I will, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Absolutely. It is our position that the order is modified. The Commonwealth's contention is that because it's a condition of probation can be modified by statute.
I agree with you.
At any time.
I agree.
The Commonwealth cites that there's no, that you cannot modify a condition of a suspended sentence. We're not really collaterally, I respect the phraseology, but we're not saying that ab initio there was something wrong with this. What we're saying is that as time has gone on, circumstances have changed and justify a modification of the order. So we're not saying originally it was wrong. We're saying all these years later, reasons and purposes and policies supporting it have changed. The child is 18, she's a majority, and the mother should have the opportunity to make a decision, and the mother, with an outreach, if she doesn't want to talk to the mother, that's fine. The mother shouldn't be held in hostage, basically, for the rest of her life. So that's our position. Now, the Commonwealth came forward and said, well, you can't do that because there's no statute, the 21 days has run, you can't, it's not probation condition. And my response is that I didn't put this in a reply brief, but it has come to me since, and I'm bringing it in oral argument, that the 19.2-303 all keeps every order, every criminal order, every sentencing order is still subject to modification by the trial court beyond 21 days. It could be 21 years, as long as the defendant, that's an extreme example, but as long as the defendant has not been delivered to a unit, the court can take judicial notice of that. So, at this point, what we don't have before us is any evidence that the defendant was ever delivered, and I personally can represent, I don't know, I've looked into that, I wasn't counsel at the time, I don't know how much time she had in, I don't know whether she stayed in the jail the whole time, whether she went to the Department of Correction, I just don't know.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal. I just...
Oh, I'm sorry. Well,
you're welcome to do it,
sure.
I just don't want you to run out of time.
That's okay. Well, but let me just finish, I'll take that chance. So our position is that with the Commonwealth raising this, they have the burden at this point of persuasion, if you will, to show the record where there is a procedural bar. They can't say that this order is not still subject to modification because the defendant, if never delivered, is still subject to modification. And so if they're going to claim that and plead that, I think they have to support facts to show that it is out of the reach of the jurisdiction. Thank you. Very animated discussion. Thank you for your questions.
How much time do we have left, Your Honor?
You have about just a little under 2 minutes.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
We'll give you a little leeway.
That should be fine. Thank you.
Counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson, and I represent the Commonwealth. I ask that you affirm the trial court judgment. To start, there is no burden on the Commonwealth as appellee to provide a record in this case. And importantly, the defendant essentially raised Rule 518, the new raised objectionable. That does not apply to appellees. There's a lot of case law that says that. I don't have a citation at my fingertips, but it does not apply to appellees. The rule itself talks about someone seeking reversal of a judgment, and I am seeking affirmance. Second, as to whether there is a record about the defendant being delivered to the Department of Corrections, that does not appear in the record. That is correct. However, in footnote 2 of my brief, I noted that this court had decided a previous case involving the defendant regarding the same conviction and noted that she was released from prison in 2005. I think that this court can always take judicial notice of its own opinions and orders, and I submitted that shows that that establishes that the defendant was in the custody of the Department of Corrections. The word prison refers to the Department of Corrections, not the local jail. So that takes it out of Section 303. And I understand that opposing counsel represented that there was no case law that applied to this particular situation. However, I disagree. This court has held, has actually discussed similar issues at least three times. I think that Grant was the Supreme Court of Virginia. But in Grant, McFarland, and Rinke, this court has discussed the differences between conditions for suspension and conditions of probation. And in Grant, the Supreme Court of Virginia looked at Code Section 192.303 and noted that probation is one of the options available to the court as a reasonable condition on the suspension of a sentence. So a probation condition is not the same as a condition for the suspension of a sentence. In McFarland and Rinke, defendants attempted to modify or appealed for modifications that were negative to them that occurred 21 days after the sentencing order was entered, and this court held that the trial court had no jurisdiction to do that. Now, it is true that I went on the statutory grounds rather than addressing an abuse of discretion, because I believe that to be the best and narrowest grounds for affirmance. Because a court can abuse discretion it does not have. The court had no discretion to do anything because the court lacks jurisdiction at this point. Several years after the entry of the order. However, you know, if the court determines to view this as an abuse of discretion case, I would submit the court properly exercised its discretion in this matter. The court had the affidavit from the now adult daughter who said that she absolutely wanted no contact with her mother, to include social media, phone calls, etc. And with that before the court, I think that the court made, you know, made a proper decision. That's something that a court could reasonably find in denying that motion to modify. However, I maintain that there was just simply no jurisdiction for the trial court to render the relief that the defendant asked for. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you,
I ask that you would affirm. Thank you.
Mr. Sachs, we'll give you a couple minutes.
I'm not sure I'm going to need much more than that, Your Honor, but thank you so much. I may please the court again. Just 3 points in reply. First, with all due respect to my able colleague and to this court, I don't think that a footnote in a brief is evidence, and I don't think the court can cite to that and say because in an earlier affirmance there was a representation in the brief. I'm not saying it was a misrepresentation, but it's not evidence.
You don't believe it's part of the record?
No, it is not part of the record.
And you don't think we can take judicial notice of our own opinion?
You can take judicial notice of your own opinion, yes. But I may have misunderstood. I thought the footnote was in the brief. Maybe I...
Correct, but yes. It's a footnote referencing a prior opinion of this court.
Right. Because this argument is just coming up, okay. I can't zero in on the precise, but I will say this. Yes, this court can take judicial notice of its opinions. I would not disagree with that. But I didn't understand that this to be evidence that you could even judicially notice because it was in somebody else's brief as opposed to evidence or judicial notice of your edicts and orders. That's the first point. The second point is the cases that she says exist that could have been cited are cases that could have been cited in a reply brief, which I elected not to file, instead to address you orally. No obligation to file a reply brief. She's talking about cases that distinguish between conditions of suspension and probation. I don't think that came after my opening brief that outlined the points and authorities that we felt apply to this case.
But why do those cases not apply in this?
They do, but I'm just referring to her honest question about that the rule where there were no cases cited in the opening brief. She hasn't cited any cases either that address this issue of this type of condition in this order.
Okay, but
other
tell
than
us,
procedural.
Okay, but tell us why those cases don't apply here.
Well, as far as suspension versus, yeah, and it gets back to
other merits.
Yes,
right.
I'm ending on my where I started. I still take the position that there's insufficient evidence in the record to say that the procedural 21-day bar fell because there is a statute that allows an order to stay alive for modification as long as the person hasn't been delivered to a unit. And we don't have any evidence one way or the other. So if they're going to raise that, we'd have to speculate and say, if the 21 days rule has hit because the court, at some point she was delivered to a prison unit, and therefore the court lost all jurisdiction. The only thing she's holding on to is that footnote, and I've already addressed that as not being sufficient to give this court record evidence. So in the absence of it, in the silence of it, I don't think the court can assume that the order is not still subject to the control of the trial court, and therefore you have the authority to review it. Lastly, the Commonwealth says they didn't address abuse of discretion, they addressed procedural. But that's still a problem because it should have been an alternative argument. I think by silence and by not addressing it, it's a concession, or at least I don't think this court can go behind that and then say, well, at oral argument, they're now saying it was an abuse of discretion. It wasn't a position in their brief. They didn't take that position before you, and I'd ask that you not take notice of it. I don't think that the question of abuse of discretion is before you in the sense that it was not contested in the Commonwealth's papers, and it's really coming down to a procedural question. If procedurally we can be here, then I don't think the Commonwealth has made an argument that it was not an abuse of discretion in their findings. So for all those reasons, Your Honor, we would move respectfully for an opinion that reverses and the judgment of the trial.
Thank you, Pam.